turning at least a dozen times and managing to avoid being caught on a single camera. Taking precautions to avoid cameras is understandable. The puzzling question is why Payne didn't bother to do the same thing. Hardwick made his acid reflux face. These oddities don't trouble Sheridan. He claims they're insignificant in the big picture. What big picture? The one in which the sniper attacks are blamed on black radicals and a demented white boy, and the playground murders are blamed on a pair of backwoods white supremacists, and all the evildoers are captured or killed, order is restored, and Beckert ascends into the political stratosphere, bringing with him his key supporters. If the plan is that clear, why the hell did Klein want you involved in the first place? I think the text message Kim Steele showed him shook him up, with its suggestion of police involvement in her husband's death. He wanted to get on board the Beckert rocket ship, but he wanted to make sure it wasn't going to blow up on the launch pad. I was supposed to observe discreetly and warn him of any imminent disasters. But apparently the so-called progress being made on the case has settled his nerves to the point where he's more concerned about me weakening his relationship with Beckert than about any weakness in the case. Hardwick flashed his chilly grin. Klein the slime. So what now? Something's screwy, and I intend to find out what it is. Even though you've been fired? Right. One last question. What the fuck am I doing here at the crack of dawn? I was hoping you might be willing to do me a favor. Doing favors for you is the icing on the cake of my perfect life. What is it this time? I thought maybe you could use your old NYSP contacts to dig a little deeper into Beckert's past. Digging for what? Anything we don't already know about his relationship with Turlock, his first wife, his son? If a cop's son starts killing cops, it doesn't take a genius to suspect there's something ugly in their past. I'd like to know what it is. Hardwick produced another grin. What's funny? Your obvious effort to concoct a theory that blames Beckert for everything. I'm not trying to concoct anything, I just want to know more about these people. Bullshit. You don't like the tight-ass son of a bitch any more than I do, and you're searching for a way to slam him. The fact that Hardwick was saying essentially what Klein had said gave the notion some extra weight, but he still wasn't about to agree with it. Hardwick took a thoughtful sip of his coffee before going on. What if Beckert is right? About what? About Steele and Loomis, about Jordan and Tooker, about Rotten Apple Corey and the Crazy Gorts. What if the prick is right about everything? What Beckert's right about seems to have a way of shifting in the wind. 3 days ago he was blaming the Steele shooting on Jordan and Tooker. When it turned out they were with a prominent pastor, he did a little rhetorical dance and said that while they might not have pulled the trigger, they certainly aided and abetted. Which may be true. And by the way, how much do you know about that pastor? What do you mean? You're assuming he's telling the truth. Maybe you just want to believe him because those alibis he provided embarrassed Del Beckert. Gurney didn't want to believe his thinking was that twisted, but the suggestion made him uneasy. Up to that point, the pastor hadn't been very high on his mental list of people to interview. Now he was at the top. 30. The Reverend Whittaker Coolidge, rector of St. Thomas the Apostle Episcopal Church, agreed to a meeting that morning, as long as it could be concluded prior to a scheduled 10:30 baptism. By breaking the speed limit all the way to White River, Gurney arrived at the church at 9:45. It was located on a broad avenue that separated Bluestone from Grinton. An old red brick building with a steeply angled slate roof, stained glass windows, and a square bell tower, it was set back from the avenue, surrounded on three sides by an ancient churchyard with moss-covered mausoleums, statues of angels, and weathered gravestones, and on the fourth side by a parking lot. Gurney parked at the back of the empty lot. From there, a path led through the churchyard to a rear door, which Reverend Coolidge had told him to use to get to the office. A little way along the path, he stopped to pay closer attention to the inscriptions on the gravestones. A few of the birth dates went back as far as the late 18th century. Most of the death dates were in the 1830s and 40s. Typical of old cemeteries, a number of the stones recorded sadly short lifespans. Dave? A large sandy-haired man in a short-sleeved shirt, Bermuda shorts, and Birkenstock sandals was standing under the outstretched wing of a stone angel that adorned one of the more elaborate graves. Taking a final drag on a cigarette, he extinguished it on the edge of the angel's wing and dropped it in a graveside watering can. Then he strode toward Gurney with a toothy smile. "I'm Whit Coolidge. I see you're intrigued by our slice of history. Some of the folks buried here were contemporaries of the controversial Colonel Ezra Willard. Are you familiar with him?" "I'm familiar with his statue in the park." "A statue some of our citizens would like to see removed, not without reason." Gurney said nothing. "Well," said Coolidge after an awkward silence, "why don't we go into my office where we can have some privacy?" Gurney wondered how much more private than a yard full of dead people the office could be, but he nodded and followed the man through the church's back door into a hallway that smelled of dust and dry wood. Light was spilling from a doorway on the right, and that's where Coolidge led him. The room was about twice the size of Gurney's den. There was a desk at one end with a leather desk chair. At the other end was a small fireplace with a low fire in its final stages. There were two leather armchairs on either side of the hearth. On one wall, a window looked out on the part of the churchyard that wrapped around that side of the building. On the opposite wall were two enormous photographic prints, one of Mother Teresa and one of Martin Luther King. Seeing Gurney looking at them, Coolidge offered an explanation. "I prefer contemporary incarnations of goodness to the bizarre and dogmatic characters of the Middle Ages." He gestured toward one of the armchairs. When Gurney was seated, he took the one facing it. "You said on the phone you were involved in the investigation of this awful violence. May I ask in what capacity?" Something in his tone suggested that he'd checked and discovered the severing of Gurney's official ties to the case. "The wives of the murdered officers have asked me to look into the circumstances of their deaths. They want to be sure they're getting the truth, whatever it turns out to be." Coolidge cocked his head curiously. "I was under the impression that our police department had already arrived at the truth. Am I mistaken?" "I'm not sure the confidence the police seem to have in their hypothesis is justified by the facts." Gurney's answer appeared to have a positive effect. The tense creases at the corners of Coolidge's eyes began to relax. His smile became more natural. "Always a pleasure to meet a man with an open mind. What can I do for you?" "I'm searching for information, with a wide net, because I don't know yet what will be important. Perhaps you could start by telling me what you know about Jordan and Tooker." "Marcel and Virgil." He made the emendation sound like a mild reprimand. "They were slandered. Even now, they continue to be slandered with the implication that they were somehow involved in Officer Steele's murder. There is, to my knowledge, no evidence of that whatsoever." "I understand they were with you the night Officer Steele was shot." Coolidge paused for a moment before going on. "They were here in this very room. Marcel, in the chair you now occupy. Virgil, in the one next to it. I sat where I am now. It was our third meeting." "Third? Was there an agenda for these meetings?" "Peace, progress, legal process." "Meaning?" "The idea was to channel negative energy toward positive goals. They were angry young men, understandably so, but not bomb throwers. Certainly not killers. They were justice seekers. Truth seekers. Perhaps like you in that way."
"What truth were they seeking?"
"They wanted to expose the numerous criminal actions and cover-ups in our police department. The pattern of abuse."
"They knew of specific instances, with evidence to back up their charges?"
"They knew of instances in which African Americans had been framed, illegally detained, even killed. They were pursuing the necessary corroboration, case files, etc."
"How?"
"They were being helped."
"Helped.
Correct."
"That doesn't tell me much."
Coolidge turned his gaze to the small blue flames flickering up from the coals in the fireplace. "I'll just say that their desire for justice was shared, and they were optimistic."
"Perhaps you could be just a bit more specific."
Coolidge looked pained. "There's nothing more I can say without discussing the implications with those who might be affected."
"I can understand that. In the meantime, can you tell me how Marcel and Virgil happened to come to you? Coolidge hesitated.
They were brought to me by an interested party.
Whose name you can't reveal without further consultation.
That's right.
Were you aware that John Steele and Rick Loomis wanted to establish some level of dialogue with the Black Defense Alliance?
I'd rather not get on the slippery slope of saying what I was or wasn't aware of. We live in a dangerous world. Confidences must be respected.
True. In Gurney's experience, agreeing with someone he was interviewing often produced more information than questioning him. He sat back in his chair.
Very true.
Coolidge sighed. I'm a student of history. I realize that political divisions are nothing new in America. We've had angry disagreements over all sorts of things, but the current state of polarization is worse than anything I've seen in my lifetime. It's stunningly ironic that the explosion of available information on the Internet has led to the irrelevance of actual facts. More communication has led to more isolation. Political discourse has become nothing but shouts and lies and threats. Political loyalties are about who you hate, not who you love, and all this ignorant bile is justified by making up nonsensical facts. The crazier the belief, the more strongly it's held. The political center, the rational center, has been driven to extinction, and the justice system... He shook his head, his hands opening and closing into fists. The justice system. Sweet Jesus, what a misnomer. In White River in particular? Coolidge was silent for a long moment, staring into the remnants of the fire. When he spoke again, his voice was calmer, but a bitterness remained.
There used to be a car wash out in Larverton. In cold weather, when there was salt on the roads and cars needed washing, the mechanism was either not operating at all or doing crazy things. Soaping when it should be rinsing, rinsing when it should be soaping, squirting wax on the tires, freezing shut with the sprayers on full blast, turning the car into a block of ice, with the driver trapped inside. The blowers were so powerful they'd sometimes rip the trim off a car.
He looked away from the fire and met Gurney's puzzled gaze.
That's our court system, our justice system. An unpredictable farce in the best of times, a disaster in times of crisis. Seeing what happens to vulnerable people pushed into the maw of that insane machine can make you cry.
So where does all this take you? Before Coolidge could respond, Gurney's phone rang. He took it out, saw that it was Torres, silenced it, and put it back in his pocket.
Sorry about that. Where does all this take me? It takes me in the direction of Maynard Biggs and the upcoming election for State Attorney General.
My Biggs. Coolidge leaned forward in his chair, his hands on his knees.
He's a reasonable man, a principled man. He listens, he begins with what is, he believes in the common good.
He sank back in his chair, turning up his palms in a gesture of frustration.
I realize, of course, that... these qualities are severe disabilities in today's political climate. But we must stand up for sanity and decency. Move from darkness toward the light. Maynard Biggs is a step in the right direction, and Del Beckert is not.
Gurney was surprised at the sudden venom in the rector's voice.
You don't regard Beckert's resignation speech as his withdrawal from public life? Ha! The world should be so fortunate. Obviously you didn't catch the latest news.
What news?
A flash polling outfit connected to RAM TV asked registered voters who they would be likely to vote for in a hypothetical election matchup between Beckert and Biggs. It was a statistical tie, a frightening fact given that Beckert hasn't officially entered the race.
You sound like you've had unpleasant encounters with him.
Not personally, but I've heard horror stories.
What kind? Coolidge appeared to be choosing his words carefully.
He has a double standard for judging criminal behavior. Crimes that arise from passion, weakness, addiction, deprivation, injustice, all those are dealt with severely, often violently. But crimes committed by the police in the name of maintaining order are ignored, even encouraged.
for instance. It wouldn't be unusual for a minority resident who dared to talk back to a cop to be arrested for harassment and jailed for weeks if he wasn't able to make bail, or beaten within an inch of his life if he offered the slightest resistance. But a cop who gets into a confrontation and ends up killing some homeless drug addict suffers zero consequences. I mean zero. Exhibit a human failing Beckett doesn't like, and you're crushed. But wear a badge and shoot someone at a traffic stop, and you're barely questioned. That's the vile, dare I say, fascist culture Beckett has installed in our police department, which he seems to consider his private army. Gurney nodded thoughtfully. Under other circumstances, he might have probed Coolidge's generalizations, but right now he had other priorities. Do you know Corey Payne? Coolidge hesitated. Yes, I do. Did you know that he was Beckert's son? How could I? You tell me. Coolidge's expression hardened. That sounds like an accusation. Sorry, just trying to find out as much as I can. What's your opinion of Payne? People in my line of work hear thousands of confessions. Confessions of every crime imaginable. People bear their souls, their thoughts, their motives. Over the years, all those revelations make one a good judge of character. And I'll tell you this. The notion that Corey Payne murdered two police officers is nonsense. Corey is all talk, angry, overheated, accusatory, I'll grant you that. But it's just talk. The thing is, said Gurney, there's extensive video and fingerprint evidence that he was in the right place at the right time for each shooting, and he fled the scene after each one. If that's true, there must be an explanation other than the one you're assuming. The idea that Corey Payne killed anyone in cold blood is ridiculous. You know him well enough to say that? White political progressives in this part of the state are a rare breed. Will you get to know each other? Coolidge looked at his watch, frowned, and stood up abruptly. We're out of time. I need to get ready for that baptism. Come. Gesturing for Gurney to follow him, he led the way out through the churchyard to the parking lot. Pray for courage and caution, he said as they reached the outback. An unusual combination. It's an unusual situation. Gurney nodded, but made no move to get into his car. Coolidge looked again at his watch. Is there something else? I'd like to meet Payne. Is that something you could arrange? So you could arrest him? I had no authority to arrest anyone. I'm a free agent. Coolidge gave him a long look. With no agenda other than gathering information for the wives of the dead officers? That's right. And you think Corey should trust you? He doesn't have to trust me. We can talk on the phone. I just have one question for him. What was he doing at those sniper locations if he wasn't involved? That's it. That's it. Gurney could easily think of a dozen other questions, but this was no time for complications. Coolidge nodded uncertainly. I'll think about it. They shook hands. The man's large, soft palm felt sweaty. Gurney looked up at the red brick edifice. St. Thomas the Apostle. Wasn't he the so-called doubting one? He was, but in my humble opinion, he should have been called the sane one. 31. If doubt was an indication of sanity, Gurney mused as he drove out of the church parking lot, he had an abundance of sanity, and it was a very uncomfortable attribute. He was filled with questions. Were Coolidge's statements fact-based conclusions, or the reflex expression of his political views? Had Jordan and Tooker been well-meaning solution-seekers, or had they been running a con job on the rector to gain his approval and an aura of respectability? Was Beckert an evil control freak or a champion of law and order in a pitched battle with criminals and chaos? And then there was Judd Turlock. Was he the tough cop advertised by the set of his jaw, or was he the hitman dwelling behind emotionless eyes? And what about Mark Torres? Were the young detective's efforts to stay in communication to be taken at face value, or were they signs of something more manipulative, possibly even an assignment he'd been given? Thinking of Torres reminded Gurney that he'd received a call from him during his meeting with the rector. He pulled over to the curb on a burned-out street at the edge of Grinton and listened to the message.
This is Mark. Just wanted to let you know there's been a setback up in the quarries. I'll tell you more when we talk.
Curious to discover if the setback would be throwing yet another aspect of the case into doubt, Gurney returned the call. Torres sounded apologetic.
The situation is kind of sensitive. I didn't want to spell it out in a message.
What's the problem?
The canine dog was killed.
The one tracking the Gorts?
Right, just below the abandoned quarries.
Killed how?
A crossbow arrow through the head? Pretty weird. Reminds me of their gate sign.
Gurney remembered it vividly, the human skull hanging there from a crossbow arrow through an eye socket. As a keep-out message, it was hard to beat.
Anything happened to the dog's handler?
No, just the dog. Arrow came out of nowhere. Another dog is on the way. An estate helicopter with infrared spotting equipment and a backup assault team.
Any official statement to the media?
Not a word. They want to keep the lid on, make sure it doesn't look like things are getting out of control.
So the Gorts are still out there with their crossbows and pit bulls and dynamite?
Looks that way.
Torres fell silent, but Gurney had the impression their conversation wasn't over.
Anything else you want to talk about?
Torres cleared his throat.
I'm not comfortable suggesting things I have no evidence for.
But?
Well, I guess it's no secret that Chief Beckert hates the Gorts.
And?
This thing with the dog seems to have tripled it.
So?
If the Gorts are captured, I have a feeling something will happen. Judge Turlock is going out to the quarries to direct the operation personally.
You think the Gorts will be killed because of the way Beckert feels about them?
I could be wrong.
I thought Beckert left the department.
He did, technically. Turlock will be acting chief until there's an official appointment, but the thing is, Turlock always does what Beckert wants. Nobody here believes that's going to change.
That worries you?
It always worries me when the face of a situation is different from the truth. A resignation should mean that you're actually gone, not just pretending to be gone. You understand what I'm saying?
Perfectly.
Not only was an appearance-reality gap a worrisome thing, it was the basic challenge in every investigation, breaking through the shell of a situation to discover what was really there.
Anything else you want to tell me?
That's it for now.
As Gurney ended the call, he noted that he still had one message he hadn't listened to yet, from Dr. Walter Thrasher. Now, while he was still parked, was as good a time as any.
David, this is Walt Thrasher. Based on what you've found so far, that excavation of yours may turn out to be of considerable historical interest. I'd like your permission to probe the area further. Please get back to me as soon as you can. Whatever it was that might be of interest to Thrasher was at that moment of little interest to Gurney. But a phone conversation with the ME could provide an opportunity to address other subjects. He placed the call. The man answered on the first ring.
Thrasher?
I got your message about the dig.
Ah, yes, the dig. I'd like to scrape around a bit, see what's there.
Are you looking for something in particular?
Yes, but I'd rather not say what. Not yet, anyway.
Something of value?
Not in the normal sense. No buried treasure.
Why all the secrecy?
I hate speculation. I have a fondness for hard evidence.
That was, Gurney thought, as good an opening as he was likely to get.
And speaking of evidence, when do you expect to get your tox screens on Jordan and Tooker back from the lab?
I emailed the report to Turlock yesterday afternoon.
To Turlock?
He's still the CIO on that case, is he not?
Yes, he is, said Gurney confidently, trying not to expose any out-of-the-loop uncertainty.
He'll probably forward your report to the DA's office, and I'll get a copy from Sheridan. Is there anything I should pay special attention to?
I report facts. Prioritizing them is up to you.
And the facts in this instance are...
alcohol, midazolam, propofol.
Propofol, as in the Michael Jackson OD?
Correct.
Propofol's administered intravenously, right?
Right.
I didn't think it was commonly available on the street.
It's not. It would be a tricky substance for the average addict to deal with.
How so?
It's a powerful sedative with a narrow therapeutic window.
Meaning?
The recommended dosage level is relatively close to the level of toxicity.
So it's easy to OD on it.
Easier than with most street drugs. And there's no antidote, no equivalent to Narcan for opiates. No way to bring you back once you go over the edge. Could a propofol OD have been the cause of death?
Direct cause of death for both individuals was strangulation, leading to heart and respiratory failure. I'd say the propofol was administered earlier for its sedative rather than toxic effects.
To eliminate the pain of the branding, to keep the victims quiet and manageable.
The sedative effect would be consistent with those outcomes.
This case gets more interesting every day, doesn't it?
Indeed. In fact, your call caught me on my way from the autopsy table back to my office.
Autopsy on who?
Officer Loomis.
I assume his death was the result of the complications you'd expect from a bullet to the temporal lobe.
The temporal lobe was creased but not perforated. He almost certainly would have recovered from that, possibly with some ongoing deficits. Of course, one can never be sure with brain injuries. His death was actually caused by complications arising from tissue destruction, sepsis, and hemorrhaging in critical brainstem structures, primarily within the medulla oblongata.
Gurney was puzzled. What's the connection between that area and the part of his head where he was shot?
No connection relevant to the outcome.
I'm confused. Are you saying that his death was not caused by the delayed effects of the gunshot to his temple?
His death was caused by the delayed effects of an ice pick driven into his brainstem.
32. Gurney didn't have time to ask Thrasher all the questions that came to mind. He settled for three big ones. First question, how long before Loomis's deteriorating condition was noted could the stabbing have occurred? The answer was that it could have occurred anywhere from 1 to 24 hours prior to the onset of symptoms. There was no way of being more specific without a more extensive analysis of the affected area of the brain, which would be undertaken if requested by the WRPD or the Office of the District Attorney. Second question. Why hadn't one of the monitor alarms sounded at the moment of the stabbing itself? The answer was that the deep sedation brought about by Loomis's barbiturate coma would have substantially blunted any immediate physiological reaction. The monitors would register the ensuing symptoms of heart and respiratory failure only as they developed during the course of the gradual brainstem hemorrhaging, deterioration, and sepsis. Third question. Wouldn't a crude instrument like an ice pick have produced a bleeding wound that the nursing staff would have noticed? The answer was that bleeding could be avoided by angling the entry pathway to avoid the principal neck arteries and veins, which is exactly what the autopsy revealed had been done. With some medical knowledge and a good anatomical diagram, it would not be all that difficult. In addition, a small band-aid had been applied to the puncture site. Gurney couldn't help but be impressed by the simplicity of that last touch. Thrasher went on to explain that his medical intern would soon be transcribing the audio recording of the detailed comments he'd made during the autopsy procedure. He would review the report, mark it preliminary, subject to revision, and send an electronic copy to Mark Torres, the official CIO on the Loomis case. Gurney knew that Torres would then share it up the chain of command to Turlock, who would in turn share it with Beckert. At some point in that process, it would occur to someone to go to the hospital and request a list of all personnel and ICU visitors who could have had access to Loomis during the broad time period in which the stabbing could have occurred. Gurney's own goal was to get to the hospital, secure the same list, and get out of there before anyone knew he'd been deprived of his official standing. The elegant lady with the white permanent and bright blue eyes was again at the welcome desk, and she remembered him. She smiled with a touch of sadness. So sorry about your associate.
Thank you.
She sighed. I wish more people appreciated the sacrifices made by you people in law enforcement. He nodded. She smiled. What can we do for you today? He spoke in a confidential tone.
We're going to need a list of hospital personnel and visitors who may have had contact with Rick Loomis.
She looked alarmed. My goodness, why?
Routine. In the event that he may have regained consciousness temporarily and said something in someone's presence that could be helpful.
Oh, yes, of course. She looked relieved. You'll need to see Abby Marsh. Let me call to make sure she's in. Do you have something with your exact title on it? He handed her his DA credentials. She laid them in front of her as she entered an extension number on her desk phone.
Hello, Marge. Is Abby in?
I have a special senior investigator here from the district attorney's office.
That's right.
Yes, he's one of the officers who was here before.
A personnel list.
He can explain it better than I can.
All right, I'll send him in.
She handed back his credentials and gave him directions to the office of Mercy Hospital's Director of Human Resources. He was greeted by Abby Marsh at her office door. Her handshake was firm and brief. She was as tall as Gurney, probably in her late 40s, thin with brown hair cropped so short it suggested recent chemotherapy. Her harried expression suggested that the days were long gone when a personnel job was a stress-free sinecure. An expanding minefield of regulations, entitlements, resentments, and lawsuits had turned the position into a bureaucratic nightmare. He explained what he needed. She asked to see his credentials and studied them in a distracted way. She told him she could provide a list of names with addresses, phone numbers, job titles, and dates of employment, but no other file information. As for indicating specific staff members with ICU access, that was impossible, since staff access to that area was neither restricted nor monitored. She looked hurriedly at her watch. Did he prefer a paper printout or a digital file? Digital. Did he want it emailed to the DA's office, or did he want it now on a USB drive? Now on a USB. It was as simple as that. He hoped his lack of candor in getting what he needed wouldn't create problems for her. There could be repercussions arising from his having presented credentials that were arguably no longer valid, but he figured that any blowback from that would be directed at him, not her. His plan was to head home and review the list she'd given him. Not that he thought it would produce any sudden insights, but it couldn't hurt to gain a familiarity with the names in the event that one popped up later in a related context. And there was a fair chance that someone on that list had been sufficiently afraid of Loomis's possible recovery, afraid of what he might reveal, to make sure it wouldn't happen. The sequence of letters and numbers on the index card flashed through Gurney's mind. If those obscure characters did in fact represent the information that Loomis had been shot and then fatally stabbed with an ice pick to prevent him from divulging, it was now more vital than ever to decipher their meaning. As he was passing the Larvitan exit on the interstate on his way back to Walnut Crossing, wondering if the digits in the message, 13111, might be a postal box number, his phone rang. It was Whitaker Coolidge. His voice was tight. Gurney couldn't tell whether from excitement or fear.
"I was able to get in touch with the individual you were asking about. I think some communication can be arranged."
"Good. Is there a next step?"
"Are you still here in town?"
"I can be back there in 20 minutes.
"Come to my office. I'll know then how to proceed."
Gurney exited at the next cloverleaf and headed back to White River. He parked in the same space by the graveyard and went into the church building by the back door. Coolidge was in his office, seated at his desk. He was in his clerical uniform, black suit, dark gray shirt, white collar. His sandy hair was combed and parted.
"Have a seat."
He pointed to a wooden chair by his desk. Gurney remained standing. The room felt chillier than it had earlier, perhaps because the fire in the grate had gone out. Coolidge interlaced his fingers. The gesture looked half prayerful, half anxious.
"I spoke to Corey Payne."
"And?"
"I think he wants to talk to you as much as you want to talk to him."
"Why?"
"Because of the murder charge. He sounds furious and frightened."
"When do we meet?"
"There's an intermediate step. I'm supposed to call a number he gave me and put the phone on speaker. He wants to ask some questions before you get together. Is that okay?"
Gurney nodded. Coolidge picked up his landline handset, tapped in a number, and held it to his ear. A few seconds later, he said,
"Yes, all set. I'm putting you on speaker."
He pressed a button and returned the handset to its base.
"Go ahead."
A sharp, edgy voice from the speaker said,
"This is Corey Payne. David Gurney, are you there?"
"I'm here."
"I have questions for you."
"Go ahead."
"Do you agree with what Del Beckert has been saying about the shootings and the Black Defense Alliance?"
"I don't have enough facts to agree or disagree."
"Do you agree with his accusation against me?"
"Same answer."
"Have you ever shot anyone?"
"Yes, A couple of psychotic murderers who were pointing guns at me.
How about shootings that weren't so easily justifiable?
There were no others, and justifiable has never meant much to me.
You don't care if a killing is justifiable?
To kill or not to kill is a question of necessity, not justification.
Really? When is killing another human being necessary?
When it will save a life that there's no other way of saving.
Including your own?
Including my own.
And you're the sole judge of that necessity?
In most cases, there's no opportunity for a broader discussion.
Have you ever framed an innocent person?
No.
Have you ever framed a guilty person? Someone you were sure was guilty, but you didn't have enough legitimate evidence to prove it in court?
No.
Have you ever wanted to?
Many times.
Why didn't you?
Because I hate liars and I don't want to hate myself. There was a silence, lasting long enough that Gurney thought the connection might have been broken. Eventually, Coolidge intervened.
Corey, you still there?
I'm thinking about Mr. Gurney's answers.
There was another silence, not quite so long.
Okay, said the voice on the speaker. We can go ahead with this.
As planned? Asked Coolidge.
As planned.
Coolidge pressed a button on the handset to end the call. He looked relieved, if not quite relaxed.
That went well.
Now what?
Now we talk.
The sharp, edgy voice came from behind Gurney. 33. Corey Payne's lean body in the doorway appeared poised to spring, but whether toward or away from Gurney was unclear. There were traces of Del Beckert in his athletic physique, chiseled face, and unblinking stare, but there was something else in his eyes as well, an acid in place of his father's arrogance. Payne and Gurney were facing each other. Coolidge was sitting behind his desk. He pushed his chair back but remained seated, as if by some peculiar calculation he had decided that the available standing room was already occupied. Gurney spoke first.
I appreciate your willingness to talk to me.
It's not a favor. I need to know what the hell is going on.
Coolidge eased his chair back a few more inches and gestured toward the armchairs by the fireplace.
Would you gentlemen like to sit down?
Without taking his eyes off Gurney, Payne moved cautiously to the brown leather chair on the far side of the hearth. Gurney took the matching one facing it. Gurney studied Payne's face.
You resemble your father.
His mouth twitched.
The man who's calling me a murderer.
Gurney paused, struck by the young man's voice. The timbre was the same as his father's, but the tone was tighter, angrier.
When did you change your name from Beckert to Payne?
As soon as I could.
Why?
Why? Because that patriarchal thing is bullshit. I had a mother as well as a father. Her name was Payne. I preferred it. What difference does it make? I thought we were going to talk about these murders I'm being accused of.
We are?
Well?
Did you commit them?
No, that's ridiculous. A stupid, disgusting idea.
Why is it ridiculous?
It just is. Steele and Loomis were good people, not like the rest of that stinking department. What's happening now scares the shit out of me.
Why?
Look at who's dead. Look at who's being blamed. Who do you think will be next?
I'm not following you.
Payne counted the names off on his fingers with increasing agitation.
Steele, Loomis, Jordan, Tooker, all dead. And who's being blamed? The Gort brothers and me. You see the pattern?
I'm not sure I do.
Seven people with one thing in common. We've all created problems for the sainted police chief. He'd be much happier if none of us existed, and now he's got four of us out of the way.
Are you claiming that your father...
Not with his own hands. That's what he has Judd Turlock for. It's amazing how many people have been killed or put in the hospital for resisting arrest since Turlock and the great Del Beckert came to White River. That's all I can think about. The minute I heard my name on that Flynn thing last night, that was my thought. I'm next. It's like living in some gangster dictatorship. Whatever the big man wants, somebody makes it happen. Whoever gets in his way ends up dead.
If you're afraid of being tracked down and shot in a manufactured confrontation, why not get yourself a good lawyer and turn yourself in?
Payne burst out in a harsh laugh.
Turn myself in and sit for God knows how long in Goodson Clouts' jail? That would just make it easier for them. In case you haven't noticed, Klaus is a slimy piece of shit, and there are people in that fucking jail who'd actually pay him for the chance to kill a police chief's son.
Gurney nodded thoughtfully. He sat back in his chair and let his gaze drift out the far window into the churchyard. In addition to giving himself a moment to consider the implications of what Payne was saying, he wanted to create an emotional break to let the young man's level of agitation subside before moving on to another subject. Coolidge's voice interrupted the silence, asking if they'd like some coffee. Gurney accepted, Payne declined. Coolidge went to prepare it, and Gurney resumed his inquiry.
We need to address some evidence issues. There's video footage of you driving a black Corolla to and from both sniper locations.
The apartment building in Grinton and the private house up in Bluestone?
Yes.
When they showed those places on the news this morning, I almost threw up.
Why?
Because I recognized the buildings. I'd been there, to both of them.
Why?
To meet someone.
Who?
He shook his head, looking both angry and scared.
I don't know.
You don't know who you were meeting?
I have no idea. People contact me. It's no secret where I stand politically. I founded White Men for Black Justice. I've been on TV. I ask for information. I publicize my phone number. Sometimes I get anonymous tips from people who want to help me.
Help you do what?
Expose the rot in our fascist police establishment.
That's why you went to those places? To meet someone who promised to help you?
He said he had a video. The actual dashboard video from the police car at the Laxton Jones shooting. A video that would expose what really happened and expose the police story as total bullshit.
It was a man's voice?
It was a text. I guess I just assumed it was from a guy. There was no name on it.
So you got this anonymous text offering you the video?
Yes.
Telling you to go to that apartment building on Bridge Street to get it?
Yes.
This was the evening of the BDA demonstration in the park?
Yes, I was supposed to drive into the alley behind the building and wait.
And you did that?
I followed the directions. I'm there in the alley at the right time, waiting. I'm there maybe 20 minutes. Then I get a text changing the plan, telling me I should drive to the far side of the Grinton Bridge. So I do, and I wait. After a couple of minutes, I get a third text. This one expresses some concern about surveillance. Says we need to postpone the meeting until it's safer. I drive home to my apartment. I'm thinking that's the end of that. Until I get a new text a couple of days later. This time it's a big rush. I have to drive immediately to a house up on Poulter Street in Bluestone. I'm supposed to drive straight into the garage and wait. I manage to get there on time, and I'm waiting, waiting, waiting. After a while, I'm thinking maybe I misunderstood. Maybe whoever's got the video is waiting in the house. I get out of the car and go to the side door. It's unlocked. I open it. Then I hear a sound that could be a gunshot from somewhere in the house. So I get the hell out. I jump in my car, tear out of there, drive home, end of story.
You drove directly to your own apartment?
To a parking spot near it, about a block away.
Any further messages from your supposed tipster?
Nothing.
Did you save the texts?
No. I wrote down the number they came from, but I deleted the actual texts.
Why?
A precaution. I'm always afraid of phone hackers or someone getting hold of private information. And this was a super sensitive thing, the dashboard video. If the wrong people found out I was going to be getting it...
His voice trailed off. Did you ever call the number the texts came from?
I tried maybe 5-6 times. No answer, just anonymous voicemail. I remember thinking maybe they had been in that house after all and maybe they got shot. Then this morning, Ram TV runs this story on the places where the sniper shots were fired from. Up till then, all they'd talked about was where the cops were when they got shot, not where the bullets came from. But now they showed the apartment building on Bridge Street and the private house on Poulter Street with some asshole reporter standing in the street pointing at it. I'm thinking, shit, that's where I was. I was in both of those places. I'm thinking, what the fuck's going on? I mean, it was obvious that something weird was going on. Put that on top of the Flynn bullshit, with the great police chief pointing his goddamn finger at me? And I'm thinking, what the fuck? What the bloody fuck?
Payne was sitting on the edge of his seat, rubbing his thighs with the palms of his hands, as if he were trying to warm them, shaking his head and staring a little wildly at the floor.
"There are fingerprints," Gurney said mildly, "in both locations."
"My fingerprints?"
"That's what I've heard."
"That has to be a mistake."
"Could be," Gurney shrugged. "If it's not, do you have any idea how they could have gotten there?"
"The only place my fingerprints could be would be in the car, which I never left except to open the side door of the house. But I never went inside, and at the apartment building I stayed down in the alley, in the car. I never got out of it."
"Do you own a gun?" Payne shook his head almost violently.
"I hate guns."
"Do you keep any kind of ammunition in your apartment?"
"Bullets? No, of course not. What would I do with them?"
He paused, looking suddenly dumbfounded.
"Fuck, are you saying someone found bullets in my apartment?"
Gurney said nothing.
"Because if someone's saying they found bullets in my apartment, that's total bullshit. What the fuck is going on?"
"What do you think is going on?" Payne closed his eyes and took a long, slow breath. He opened them and met Gurney's inquisitive gaze with an unblinking Beckert stare. "It would appear that someone is trying to frame me. Someone who's covering up for whoever was actually involved in the shootings."
"Do you believe your father is trying to frame you?"
He continued staring at Gurney as if he hadn't heard the question. Then the hard expression began to break down. There were little tremors around his eyes and mouth. He stood up abruptly, turned away, and walked to the window that looked out on the old graveyard. Gurney waited. A long minute passed. Payne spoke, still facing the window.
"I think so. I don't think so. I'm sure, not sure. I think, sure, of course he'd frame me. Why not? He has no feelings other than ambition. Ambition is sacred to him. Success, sacred to him and his horrible second wife, Haley Beauville Beckert. You know where her money comes from? Tobacco. Her great-great-grandfather, Maxwell Beauville, owned a huge slave plantation in Virginia, one of the biggest tobacco growers in the state. Jesus, you know how many people tobacco kills every day? Fucking greedy, murdering scumbags. And then I think, no. My father? Frame me for murder? That's impossible, right? Yes, no, yes, no."
He let out a small gasping sound that might have been a stifled sob.
"So," he said finally, taking a deep breath, "I don't know a single fucking thing."
Gurney decided to change the subject. "How close are you to Blaze Jackson?" Payne turned from the window, calmer now.
"Blaze Lovely Jackson, she insists on the whole name. We had an affair, on and off. Why?"
"Is she the one who gave you Devilon Jones's Corolla?"
"She lets me use it whenever I need it."
"Are you staying with her now?"
"I'm moving around."
"Probably not a bad idea." There was a silence. Coolidge came back into the room with Gurney's coffee. He laid the mug on a side table by the arm of Gurney's chair, then, with a concerned glance in the direction of Payne, retreated behind his desk. Payne looked at Gurney.
"Can I hire you?"
"Hire me?"
"As a private investigator, to find out what the hell is going on?"
"I'm already trying to do that."
"For the cops' wives?"
"Yes."
"Are they paying you?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Because you're bound to have expenses. Investigations can be expensive."
"What's your point?"
"I'd like to make sure you have the resources to do whatever you have to do."
"You're in a position to supply those resources?"
"My grandparents left their money to me, not to my mother. They locked it up in a trust fund that only I could access, and only after I turned 21, which was last year."
"Why did they do that?" Payne paused, gazing at the ashes in the fireplace.
"My mom had a serious drug problem. Giving someone with a drug problem a pile of money is like a death sentence."
He paused again.
"Besides, they hated my father and wanted to make sure he wouldn't get his hands on it."
"They hated him? Why?"
"Because he's a horrible, heartless, controlling bastard."
34. The meeting ended with Gurney declining to be hired, but leaving open the possibility of billing Payne for any extraordinary expenses, if they happened to result in the discovery of facts that exonerated him. With Payne leery of providing Gurney with his cell number, a new one, anonymous and prepaid, for fear of the police getting hold of the number and tracking his location,
Coolidge had nervously agreed to act as a middleman. Now, 35 minutes later, Gurney was finishing a quick lunch in an empty coffee shop on one of White River's main commercial avenues, playing back in his mind everything he remembered Payne saying, how he said it, his expressions, gestures, apparent emotions. The more he thought about it, the more inclined he was to accept the feasibility of Payne's narrative. He wondered how Jack Hardwick, ultimate skeptic, would react to it. He was sure of one thing. If it was all just a performance by a clever murderer, it was one of the best, maybe the best, he'd ever witnessed. He took a final bite of his ham and cheese sandwich and went to the cash register to pay. The apparent owner, a middle-aged man with a sad Slavic face, stood up from a nearby booth and came over to take his money.
"Nuts, huh?
Excuse me?" The man gestured toward the street.
"Lunatics, wild, smash. Burn."
"Even in this part of town?"
"Every part, maybe not burning yet, but could be. Just as bad, almost. How can you sleep thinking how crazy? Burning, shooting, crazy shit."
He shook his head.
"No waitresses today, afraid, you know." "Okay, I understand. No matter, maybe. No customers. They're afraid too, so everybody stay home. Hide in closet, maybe. What good is this shit? They burned down their fucking house, right? For what? For what? What we supposed to do now? Buy guns, all of us? We shoot each other? Stupid. Stupid."
Gurney nodded, took his change, and headed for his car on the nearly deserted street. By the time he got to it, his phone was ringing.
"Gurney here. This is Whit Coolidge. After you left, Corey was thinking about something you said, about video footage of him driving to and from the places where the shots were fired." "Yes." "He says, and I agree, the traffic cameras along those routes are pretty obvious. Anyone who'd ever driven around White River would know they were there." "So?" "If the killer knew they were there, wouldn't he avoid them?" "It's a reasonable question." "So what we're thinking is maybe it would make more sense to be looking for someone who doesn't appear on those videos." "That did occur to me." "Oh, well, you said so little at the meeting it was hard to know what you were thinking." "I learn more from listening than from talking." "Absolutely true. A principle we should all live by, and one we so easily forget. Anyway, we just wanted to share that thought with you on the video issue." "I appreciate it."
After he ended the call, Gurney sat for a while in his parked car, picturing the map Mark Torres had displayed, the one showing the route taken by the red motorcycle and its anonymous leather-clad rider, the route painstakingly reconstructed by interviewing people who'd glimpsed or heard the loud bike zipping by, a route that went all the way from Poulter Street to Willard Park, managing to avoid every traffic camera in the city, while Corey Payne in the black Corolla was being recorded by one after another. Gurney was tempted to drive over to the park yet again, to the last reported location of the motorcycle, before it presumably disappeared into one of several wilderness trails. But he'd been there three times already, and there were two locations critical to the case that he hadn't yet visited. It was time he did. Keys would be required. He placed a call to Mark Torres. While Gurney's exiled status had not diminished Torres's willingness to cooperate with him, it had made it inadvisable to do so openly. They arrived at a plan that would allow Gurney to examine Corey Payne's apartment and the apartment used for the Steele shooting without necessitating any direct contact. Torres would see to it that the doors of both apartments would be unlocked for 1 hour that afternoon, from 2:30 to 3:30. It would be up to Gurney to conduct his examinations within that time frame, attracting as little attention as possible. He arrived at the Steele sniper site at 2:31. The five-story building, like many in White River, had seen better days. He recalled from the video shown in one of the CSMT meetings that the apartment number was 5C. Apartment buildings of less than six stories were not legally required to have elevators, and this one didn't. By the time he reached the fifth floor, he was breathing a bit more heavily than he would have liked. It reminded him to add some aerobic exercise to his regimen of push-ups and chin-ups. He'd recently turned 50, and staying in shape required more effort than it used to. The apartment door looked as if it hadn't been cleaned in years.
The reinforced steel peephole was as clear a statement of urban decline as the stink of urine in the stairwell. As planned, the door was unlocked. If there had been crime scene tape across it, it had been removed. The interior layout, a small foyer leading into a large room with a kitchenette and bathroom on the right, was as he remembered it from the video, except that the large window was now closed. The faint tripod marks were still visible on the dusty floor. Standing in the center of the triangle formed by the three marks and gazing out through the streaky window panes, he could see in the distance the spot at the edge of Willard Park where John Steele had been struck down. Looking around the empty room, his gaze fell on the ancient steam radiator under which the brass casing had been found. The bottom of the radiator was at least 4 inches from the floor, leaving the space beneath it easily visible. He went into the small kitchen and saw nothing out of the ordinary beyond the residue of fingerprint powder left by the evidence tech on various handles, cabinets, and drawers. Next he went into the bathroom, the room that most interested him, especially the toilet, and the flushing lever in particular. He inspected it carefully, then opened the water tank and examined the inner workings. His eyes widened. What he was looking at suggested an explanation for Payne's fingerprints being found on the flushing mechanism, on a greasy food wrapper in the toilet bowl, on the brass casing in the living room, and nowhere else in the apartment. It had bothered him from the beginning that no fresh prints had been found on any of the doors or on the open window sash. Now he thought he knew why. But he wanted an additional piece of evidence to corroborate the explanation before he shared it with Torres. He took several photos of the toilet tank with his phone, then took a quick look around the apartment to be sure he was leaving everything as he found it. He hurried down the 4 flights of stairs, breathing in as little as possible of the sour smell, went out through the lobby onto Bridge Street, and drove to the address Torres had given him for Payne's apartment. It was located on the far side of Willard Park. The neighborhood was run down, but had not yet been visited by the sporadic fires and looting that had pockmarked the rest of the Grinton section. The air, however, had the ashy odor that seemed to have penetrated every corner of the city. The building was a narrow 3-story brick structure with a weedy vacant lot on either side. There were 2 apartment floors above a storefront. Steel security shades were pulled down over the store windows. A hand-printed sign on the door said, "Closed." A more professional sign over the barricaded window said, "Computer Repairs." The building had 2 front entrances, one to the store, the other to a stairwell providing access to the apartments. Payne's was on the 2nd floor. The door, unlocked as promised, opened into a dark foyer that led to a living room with a partial view of the forested area of the park. There was a faint sewer-like smell in the room. The furniture was disarranged. The rug had been rolled back to one side of the room, the couch and chair pillows heaped on the floor. Chairs had been turned over, desk drawers removed, bookcase shelves emptied. A power strip and a tangle of wires on the floor indicated the former presence of a computer. Light fixtures had been opened, blinds taken down from the windows. The place had evidently been subjected to a thorough police search. A doorway on the left side of the living room led to a bedroom with what appeared to be the apartment's only closet. The bureau drawers had been removed and emptied. The mattress had been removed from the box spring, and the clothes from the closet. In the corners of the room there were random piles of underwear, socks, shirts, pants. If Gurney had more time, he would have gone through all of it, but he had a more urgent interest. He left the bedroom and crossed the living room to a pair of open doorways. One led to the kitchen, where he found fingerprint dust everywhere, ransacked cabinets and drawers, an open refrigerator. The sewer-like odor was stronger here than in the living room. The doorway next to the kitchen led to a hallway, at the end of which he could see the bathroom, the room he was most interested in, and the source of the foul odor. The drainage trap under the sink had been removed, opening the room to the effluvia of the building's sewer lines. The medicine cabinet was empty. There were no towels. The toilet seat had been removed. Gurney lifted the top off the toilet tank and peered down at the flushing mechanism and at the flushing lever on the outside of the tank. With a feeling of satisfaction, he took out his phone and photographed both. He checked the time. There were still 15 minutes remaining of the hour Torres had given him. His initial thought was to use every minute of it sifting through whatever the police had left behind.
His second thought was to be satisfied with what he'd discovered and get the hell out of there. That was the thought he acted on. He was out of the building in his car and heading for Walnut Crossing with 13 minutes to spare. He didn't stop until he reached the interstate rest area where he'd had his initial conversation with Torres. It seemed an appropriate place to pull over, thank him for his assistance, and fill